welcome to Cricket in England through five matches. In this series of podcasts, we have been examining early 20th century English history and culture through the prism of the game of cricket. And each time, we've done so by looking at a single match. In this, the last of the current series, we look at the approach of war in 1939 and visit Hove for Sussex versus Yorkshire. The more things change, the more they stay the same. It had only been 25 years since the start of the devastating conflict that had become known as the Great War, and Britain was staring down the barrel of a gun once more. 25 years, shorter than the test career of Wilfred Rhodes, the blink of an eye. And how was this England that stood on the brink of another great battle? Look one way, and it was far from the England of 1914. Look another, and it seemed not to have changed. As in life, as in cricket. This was not the same game played by Blythe or Fry or the grand old man Grace. Yet, in another light, it was just that. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
For a while we must part, but remember me, sweetheart. Till the lights of London shine again. And while I'm over there...
Many of the changes in English society, politics and economics that took place in the interwar years were continuations of trends that predated the Great War. Britain, by 1913, had lost its place as the world's leading manufacturer, and that relative decline continued in the post-war world to the point that, by 1939, its share of world manufacturing had fallen to 9%, behind the United States, Russia, and Germany. At home, changes to social fabric would move on apace, yet the diminishing control of British political institutions by the aristocratic class in the interwar years was but an extension of a movement that dated back to the Great Reform Act of 1832, and continued through further extensions of electoral suffrage, the taming of the House of Lords in the Parliament Act of 1911, and the rise of the Labour Party. Such social disruption reached the highest political office. The resignation of the Marquess of Salisbury from the post of Prime Minister in 1902 marked the last time a member of the House of Lords would occupy No. 10 Downing Street. Men of aristocratic heritage would, of course, lead governments again, but never while in possession of their inherited title. The early 20th century saw men from the lower classes promoted to the top job in party politics. Liberal Prime Minister David Lloyd George was raised by his mother Elizabeth and her brother Richard Lloyd, a cobbler and a Baptist minister. Labour's first Premier, Ramsay MacDonald, was the illegitimate son of a crofter. Who was and who was not part of the British elite was also in flux, much to the dismay of some from the old aristocracy. Industrialists, or worse, war profiteers, were taking their place at the top table through marriage or the purchase of land. Even the House of Lords, that bulwark of the British aristocracy, had seen an influx of new money, including some who had directly purchased a title from the government of Lloyd George. Knighthoods could be bought for £10,000. A peerage would set you back in excess of £50,000. The intangible feature of English aristocratic life, known as society, was similarly changing. The country house, such a staple of the pre-war social calendar, was under threat as many landed aristocratic families faced pressing financial straits which could lead to the sale of parts of, if not the entire estate. The stabilisation of the food supply after the end of the conflict led to a drop in the prices of wheat, barley and oats, and helped contribute to a collapse of land values during the 1920s that, along with a sharp fall in agricultural rents, presented huge financial challenges for those whose family wealth was tied to rural land ownership. Rising taxes challenged them further. A wartime super tax on annual incomes over £10,000 was retained, and it was assessed on gross income rather than net, a particular problem for landowners with larger than average outgoings due to the demands of property upkeep. Inheritance taxes added to the pressure on landed gentry to sell up. In 1919, estate duties on properties valued over £2 million were set at 40%. By 1930, that figure was 50%. By 1939, 60%. Further financial strains were felt in families where the male head of the household had been killed or seriously injured during the war. And in some cases, the wives and widows of these men found themselves having to work to sustain the lifestyle to which they had become accustomed. The effect of all this was an increasing metropolitanisation of the upper class, as families looked to uncouple their fortunes from their landed estates and other property, adding to and caused by the wider interwar change from a British economy based on land and international finance to one centred on commerce and manufacturing. Some land from aristocratic estates was rented out, some sold to tenant farmers, and other parts were snapped up by the nouveau riche in an attempt to cement their social status. England, lamented the Times newspaper, is changing hands. Also changing were the attitudes of many of the young aristocracy towards their expected place in society and how they should be seen to behave. For some of that younger generation, the certainty and stability that came with their social position had been torn apart by the war, and they looked to carve out a new freedom for themselves, often very publicly. The antics of these so-called bright young things and the dazzle of high society remained attractive to the newsreel cameras and newspaper editors. However, while the young aristocrats of the 1920s and 1930s retained their social cachet, they increasingly shared the limelight with the equally glamorous stars of cinema screen, stage and gramophone. The criteria for inclusion in this new elite was quickly becoming one of fashion and glitz, rather than simply title or breeding. Nightclubs became an increasingly popular place for the young upper class to let down their hair, with even the Prince of Wales being spotted in the night spots of Bond Street and Piccadilly. If the upper classes appeared to be in danger of losing their footing, the middle classes seemed to be on the rise. After a few rocky years immediately after the war, middle-class Britons began to enjoy a more prosperous time, particularly when compared to those both below and above them in the social strata. A combination of a lowering of the cost of living beginning in the 1920s, relative stability in the level of pay for those in salaried professions, along with comparatively low middle-class unemployment even during the years of the Great Depression, saw those in professional and management roles having by far the best of it. The extra spending power allowed people to enjoy more fruit, vegetables, eggs and milk, and more sugar too. Many children able to relish in the arrival of new chocolate brands such as Mars bars, Milky Ways and Smarties. New technologies were also making their way into the home, with luxuries such as the wireless and the refrigerator becoming affordable objects for many. Even the motor car was no longer the preserve of the rich. One of the largest changes in interwar British life was the rise in levels of home ownership. The rise in middle-class spending power, together with slum clearance programmes and increased house building, opened up the possibility of owning your own home for more people than ever before. If Britain did not completely shift from being a nation of renters to one of owner-occupiers, the proportion of the population who did live in their own property increased from 10% at the outbreak of the First World War to 35% on the eve of the Second. While the 1920s and 30s were good for some, however, those in waged or casual employment faced a much more difficult time. From the start of the war until about 1920, wages increased all round, particularly for unskilled workers. Unfortunately, this would not last, and between 1920 and 1923, wage levels fell quickly. Those working in the mines hit especially hard. When earnings began to stabilise from 1923 onwards and prices continued to fall, many workers saw an uptick in their spending power. The problem here was for that to happen, they needed to be in work, and many were not. It was a sad fact of the interwar period that most working-class Britons experienced unemployment at one point or other, something most middle-class families did not. In 1931 alone, at any chosen time, one-fifth to one-quarter of the lower class was out of work. Those who had relied on industries such as coal mining, shipbuilding, heavy engineering and textiles suffered more than most, and given that such ways of life were overwhelmingly based in the north of England, west of Scotland and South Wales, these regions suffered most too. With wages decreasing and industry facing pressure, it was not a surprise that industrial strife followed in its wake. In the first few years of the 1920s, with trade unions looking to prevent a fall in workers' pay, the nation saw more strike action than in any year previously. There is an irony in that the decline in the number of strike days lost in the later years of the 1920s and the early 1930s was partly due to the rising levels of unemployment, especially in areas and industries with a strong union history. Employment, after all, was an essential condition for a strike. When unemployment began to fall in the later years of the 1930s, levels of industrial action rose once more. In industrial relations, however, all industries and areas of the country were not equal, and the mining and textile communities of South Wales, Yorkshire and Lancashire were more strike-prone than many others. Even in 1926, the year of the general strike, over 90% of the total days lost to industrial action were the result of miners' strikes. By the time of the outbreak of the Second Great War, these patterns, at least as far as the middle and working classes were concerned, began to reverse themselves. As the need for rearmament increased the demand for labour, manual wages began to rise precisely at the moment when middle-class spending levels stalled. In terms of industry itself, much of the damage was already done, and mining, shipbuilding and textiles struggled to meet the new demand brought about by the needs of a nation preparing for another long conflict. In so many ways, then, the interwar years were a time of flux for all social classes. Yet the Britain of 1939 was, in so many other ways, the same as that of 1918. It was still a predominantly working-class country. The middle classes had grown and had seen the stirrings of change in their character, but any greater shift would need to wait for the effects of another war to take hold. Organised industrial action was a notable feature of the period, but yet a majority of workers still did not belong to a union. Membership levels kept low, partly because of the difficulty unions appeared to have in attracting women. Indeed, the plight of women in the workforce typified the tensions between the old and new. Progress was clear. Full electoral suffrage was won in 1928. The American-born Lady Astor had already become the first female Member of Parliament in 1919, and the 1929 general election saw 14 women take seats in the House of Commons. Having seen many previously male-dominated avenues of employment open up during the First World War, Parliament, in 1919, passed the Sex Disqualification Removal Act to ensure that civil employment could not once again be closed off to women. Yet, in the interwar period, there was no noticeable increase in the proportion of women in employment, and the number working on equal terms with men saw a decline. Of the 1.3 million women who entered employment during the war, the vast majority were no longer in work by 1921. Some returned to the home voluntarily, others were a victim of a backlash in traditionally male industries. Marriage would often see the end of employment, with many employers still only willing to employ unmarried women, including in the public sector, where such a policy was supposed to be unlawful. Rising levels of unemployment, particularly in the textile industry, forced many women out of work, often the first to be disposed of. In 1933, Sir Herbert Austin, the motor company chief, actually suggested that sacking women would be an ideal remedy for unemployment. So, Despite some post-war optimism that traditional gender roles in work had started to be challenged, the fundamental imbalances remained, and the most popular avenue of employment for the semi-skilled female worker in the interwar years continued to be domestic service. For the upper classes, they still remained an indisputable social, political and financial elite. For all the financial challenges and the infiltration of their ranks and families by new money and Americans, very little of the redistribution of wealth that occurred in this period was from upper to middle classes. Most of the movement of money was within the elite, and by 1939, the richest 1% of the population still held well over half of all Britain's wealth. Despite the fears of the demise of upper-class society, when George VI ascended to the throne in 1937, London still resounded to the sound of aristocratic balls and social events. Richer or poorer, the face of the aristocracy would continue to be upheld. In the words of Lelia Ponsonby, Duchess of Westminster, "One dressed for dinner, though the skies fell." As in life, as in cricket, the game in this period was essentially the same played by Grace and Abel, still awash with the expectations and traditions of class, of the player and the gentleman. But change was tugging the coat of this most conservative of all sports. We saw in episode 3 of this series how war had taken its toll on the ranks of amateur cricketers. It was a trend that would continue. As the economic realities of this interwar period began to bite, fewer amateurs could find the time to turn out for their county side, and teams began to rely much more on their professional players. In 1913, 30% of all county cricketers were drawn from the amateur class. By 1930, that figure had dropped to 20% and kept around that level for the remainder of the decade. Not all counties were alike in this regard. Lancashire, Nottinghamshire and Yorkshire tended to field sides dominated by professionals, whereas for a county such as Somerset, the reverse was true. By 1939, however, the decline in the numbers of amateurs was to affect all sides, with only Kent seeing more than 30% of their side unpaid. Cracks were also beginning to appear in the customs which sustained the cultural barriers between amateur and professional. The tradition of the two cricketing classes changing in different rooms and entering the field of play was being chipped away at. The 1920s saw Surrey abolish separate entrances at the Oval, and the MCC adopted a single dressing room for England teams. Formalities between the cricketing classes were also beginning to move. In the pre-war era, professionals would always address their amateur colleagues as Sir or Mr. While such niceties mostly endured in the interwar period, it was increasingly common to hear an amateur captain being called Skipper by his professional charges. Some dared to go further. Gloucestershire's Wally Hammond shocked Surrey's captain Errol Holmes by hailing him as Errol, an act which made the amateur wonder if he should report Hammond for such audacity. Wally Hammond was one of a different breed of professionals who were beginning to appear. Grammar school educated, he dressed and held himself with the air of an amateur. The brill-creamed hair, the silk handkerchief which peeped from his trouser pocket. He played golf, drove to training by car, and would dip into his pocket to ensure his accommodation was of a higher standard than that which was usually experienced by a professional. Marrying into money, his wife was a Bradford wool merchant's daughter, Hammond crossed the cricketing class boundary in 1938 and played the rest of his career as an amateur. In his professional days, it also helped his earning power that Wally Hammond was one of the world's best batsmen, but he was not alone. The cream of the professional crop, Hobbs, Hendren and others, earned the sort of money that comfortably put them in the bracket of middle rather than working class, taking home more a year as a cricketer than they would as a GP. They were, however, the exceptions, and most professionals still led the lifestyle of workers. Professionals were also establishing themselves in positions of authority in the national game, with Jack Hobbs and Wilfred Rhodes invited to join the England selection committee. Such professional influence did not yet extend to the formal reins of captaincy. However, with fewer and fewer amateurs pulling on a county cap, and the ranks of the professionals now supplying the outstanding cricketers of the day, the question of whether professionals should be permitted to captain a side continued to stir. Although largely unspoken, there was a growing recognition that captaincy was still being reserved for the amateur alone for reasons that had little to do with who was the best leader of a side on the field of play. This was evident by the number of professionals who were asked to deputise when their usual amateur skipper was unavailable. In 1926, Jack Hobbs led the England side in the absence of Arthur Carr. Ewart Astle captained Leicestershire for the entire 1935 season until the amateur Stewie Dempster qualified for the county the next year. And in 1927, Herbert Sutcliffe accepted the full-time captaincy of Yorkshire until pressure from dissenting voices prompted him to decline. There was an irony that Lord Hawke, the man who had denounced so strongly the idea of a professional ever captaining England, had been behind the offer to Sutcliffe in the first place. Yorkshire would be captained by amateurs right up until 1960. Hawke's fellow cricketing peer of the realm, Lord Harris, was not so flexible over the issue of in whose hands a county captaincy should reside. When Stanley Cornwallis, the captain of Harris's county of Kent, was going to be absent from duty, the skipper suggested that James Seymour, a professional, step into the breach rather than one of the other amateurs in the side. Hawke was outraged and sent Cornwallis a strong rebuke by letter, reminding the captain that the authority granted to him by the county committee did not include the revolutionary introduction of a professional to be captain when an amateur is procurable. Seymour would never formally lead his county. If there was to be a softening of the line of who held the reins of captaincy, it would be helped by the fact that age was catching up with cricket's old guard. Lord Harris, such a stickler for rules and tradition, passed away in 1932 and was followed, 6 years later, by Lord Hawke. Change was occurring elsewhere in cricket. As we saw in episode 4, test status had been extended to the West Indies, India and New Zealand, although of those three, only the West Indies managed to secure any victory before war forced a halt to test competition. On the domestic front, the number of teams competing in the county championship rose to 18, with the inclusion of Glamorgan in 1921, a move that meant it was no longer an all-English affair. The laws of the English game were also in flux during the interwar period, with the MCC looking to find ways in which to redress the balance of the contest, which many felt had become too much a batsman's game. Pad play had become more and more common, with batsmen often reluctant to offer anything other than a leg or a leave to balls pitching outside of off stump, some going as far as to kick the ball away. Bowlers grew frustrated, and the spectacle did nothing for the entertainment value of the sport. To counter the trend, bowlers were awarded some new advantages. In 1927, the ball was made smaller. The stumps became larger in 1931. And in 1937, the leg before wicket rule was amended to allow umpires to raise the finger for balls which pitched outside of off stump, as long as they hit the pad in line with the stumps. Less welcome to the bowling fraternity was another innovation designed to move the game along, the adoption, in 1939, of the 8-ball over. This had been the standard in most Australian cricket since 1918, and had more recently been adopted by South Africa and re-adopted by New Zealand. West Indies cricket made the change along with the MCC. The 1939 English season began, 8 balls in and over and all, with Yorkshire as reigning champions. It would have taken a brave person to bet against them repeating the feat, boasting as they did an opening partnership of Len Hutton and Herbert Sutcliffe, a bowling attack spearheaded by Bill Bowes and Hedley Verity, along with a supporting cast of test cap cricketers such as Maurice Leyland, Arthur Mitchell, Norman Yardley, Wilf Barber and Arthur Wood, led ably by their no-nonsense captain, Brian Sellers. Yorkshire's defence of their championship would be a robust one, finishing with an identical win-loss ratio, 20-2, as they had achieved in 1938, increasing their point tally by 4 via the first innings point system, and so upping their average point score, the statistic that determined who would finish top of the table. Only a challenge by Middlesex kept the race alive into late August, but when they drew against Surrey at Lord's on August the 30th, ending their chase, the title was Yorkshire's again. It was the 12th time Yorkshire had been crowned champions in the 21 seasons played since the end of the First World War. Hutton ended the year as the county championship's leading run scorer. Verity finished second in the wicket takers list, but managed to top the national bowling averages. As in 1914, the season was played out under a gathering threat of war, but this time, in 1939, the atmosphere was different. Memories of the last conflict were fresh, and few were under any misapprehension of what another war would mean this time round. No more expectations of the boys being back home by Christmas. While before, events had moved swiftly, catching many on the hop, now the writing had been clearly on the wall for some time. By the start of the 1939 County Championship in early May, German forces had already overrun Czechoslovakia, making a mockery of Prime Minister Chamberlain's assurance of peace in our time. As Britain sought to reassure Poland of their commitment in the face of further Nazi aggression, steps were hurriedly taken at home to prepare for conflict. The pace of rearmament was increased, and on May the 26th, the day before Yorkshire and Lancashire took up the Roses battle at Old Trafford, Parliament passed the Military Training Act, which allowed for the conscription of 20 and 21-year-old men into first basic training and then into active reserve. Despite all this, unlike in 1914, there were no calls for the immediate cessation of sporting contests, rather a sober realisation that when war was declared, sport would stop. But until then, people would carry on as best they could. In the darkness of early August the 9th, a few hours before Sussex took on Worcestershire at New Road and Yorkshire played Leicestershire at Elston Road, householders across a great swathe of the country took part in a practice blackout. RAF bombers were called on to make a surprise mock attack to be met by fighter aircraft, flying low to check the effectiveness of the efforts of the population to extinguish or cover any light. Unfortunately, from an aerial viewpoint at least, bad weather contrived to frustrate those plans. With war beginning to take on an air of inevitability, and the nation's preparations accelerating, the cricket season rolled on as normal. A test series between England and the visiting West Indies passed without interruption. England took the three-match series 1-0, Hutton and Hammond leading the way with the bat for the home team, Bowes and Derbyshire's Bill Copson with the ball. For the visitors, it was incomparable George Hedley who predictably plundered most runs, Leary Constantine the main bowling threat. Soon after the conclusion of the final test match, the West Indian tour party received notice from Kent that their fixture scheduled for August the 30th at Canterbury was to be cancelled. The abandonment of this match prompted the tourists to decide that it would be preferable to make their voyage home before any outbreak of hostilities, and calling off the other remaining five fixtures, left the British Isles on the 26th of August, catching the SS Montrose from Greenock to Montreal. The news of the premature West Indian departure was not well received on the south coast, where the tourists were due to play at Hove on the very day they set sail for Canada. With only a day's warning of the fixture's cancellation, Sussex's captain, Jack Holmes, attempted some last-minute diplomacy in an ultimately futile effort to change their mind. "Essential to play tomorrow," he messaged the West Indian tour management. Keep the flag flying. John Nansen, the mayor of Brighton, lent his weight to the efforts, admonishing the victors with a warning that their early return home would certainly give the impression that we are not putting up a united front. It was to no avail. The tour was off, and the majority of the West Indian team sailed to Canada, where a hastily arranged match was played against Montreal before the players went on to their homes. The apparent haste in which the tourists made their decision to set sail at the very first opportunity was not well received by many of the West Indian cricketers either. The batsman, Jeff Stollmeyer, reported that his captain, Rolf Grant, nearly had a riot on his hands when he relayed the news to his men. Their swift exit turned out to be a lifesaver. Had they hesitated for another day before leaving, their next chance would have been aboard the SS Athenia, which departed Glasgow towards Montreal on September the 1st. 2 days into the journey, the Athenia became the first British ship to be hit by a German U-boat during the Second World War. 117 lives were lost. August 30th, 1939, Hove. Sussex versus Yorkshire. Day one. It was a lovely day to be by the coast. The previous few days had been warm, bright, a little cloudy at times, but had been spared any of the thunderstorms rattling around more easterly and northerly parts of Britain. As the players gathered on that Wednesday morning, they were greeted by clear blue skies and the promise of temperatures reaching into the mid-70s. One thing was clear, once the morning dew had evaporated, this would be a good day to bat. And so, when the coin fell Sussex's way, their skipper, Jack Holmes, had no hesitation in announcing his decision to do just that. And soon the Sussex opening pair of Bob Stainton and John Langridge made their way to the crease. It was, in truth, an odd sort of occasion. It should have been one of celebration. The visit of the champions, one final chance to catch sight of the talents of the likes of Hutton, Leyland, Verity and Bowes before the season's close. The fixture had been intended as the main attraction for the Brighton and Hove Cricket Week, and if that were not enough, it had been set aside to act as a benefit match for the popular Sussex professional, Jim Parkes. Yet the context in which the match began gave little reason for joy. The slide to war now seemed unstoppable, and with the destruction of the 1914 to 1918 conflict still fresh in the mind, people were under no illusions as to what that could mean. As spectators strolled along Eaton Road to the gates of the county ground, the sea glistening in the background, they would have known that this was not only the last chance to see their Sussex side and those Yorkshire greats in 1939, but for a considerably longer time, and who knew, for some, perhaps their last time ever. Yet come they did, and in good numbers, 4,000 on the first day. Perhaps they were spurred on by the knowledge that another opportunity for a long summer's day at the cricket may not come again soon. Perhaps they came for a little light relief from the spectre of war. Or possibly, the people of Sussex just wanted to show their support for Jim Parkes' benefit. Parkes had become a highly effective batting all-rounder for the South Coast County. Although he made his first-class debut in 1924, he took a few years to fully settle and finally found his rhythm in 1927 when he recorded his first 1,000-run season, picking up 44 wickets to boot. A stockily built, brave opening batsman, he developed a productive partnership with John Langridge, and from 1927 to 1939 would pass 1,000 runs in all but one domestic season. His batting was his bread and butter, but he ably supplemented it with dependable bowling spells, often picking up wickets with his slow medium in-swingers, and a good pair of hands at second slip. While it would be fair to describe Jim Parkes as a very effective county pro rather than a stellar one, there was one year in which he would reach heights that very few cricketers had scaled before or since. The year was 1937, and Jim Parkes was unstoppable. 3,003 runs came from his bat that summer, at an average of over 50, with 11 tons and another 11 half-centuries. If that wasn't enough, he picked up over 100 wickets for only the second time in his career. This run of form was enough to give Parkes a test cap. Against New Zealand at Lord's, opening the innings with Hutton, he scored 22 and 7 and took 3 wickets, but his services were not required for the next test, and it would remain his only international appearance. Jim Parkes was 34 years old when Yorkshire visited Hove for his benefit game. In normal times, he could have expected to serve his county for another 5-6 years, perhaps more. But these were no normal times, and Jim Parkes would not play for Sussex again. He would pick up the bat after the war for Canterbury in New Zealand and Nottinghamshire's second 11, playing until the fine age of 54. But as with so many, the coming conflict would rob him of first-class cricket. There was no denying that Parkes' benefit match was taking place in a strange atmosphere. Every effort was made to make the day one of celebration. A band played on the lawn, teas were served by a group of volunteers led by Lady Eva de Paravancini. Yet conversations inevitably drifted back to more sombre affairs, and throughout the day, groups of spectators would be seen gathered around parked cars, listening to wireless reports of the last fruitless efforts of ministers and diplomats. The Sussex professional George Cox reflected on the contrast. "The tension was awful," he said. "There was a feeling that we shouldn't be playing cricket, yet there was also a festive air. We knew that this was to be our last time of freedom for many years, and so we enjoyed ourselves while we could." Bill Bowes recalled the match being played in a most strained atmosphere, where people watched the match, but their minds were on the war. Stainton and Langridge, amateur and professional, both 29 years old, took their places at either end of the freshly rolled pitch. At this time of year, it was obligatory to pay extra caution, even on a true surface, in case the morning dew caused the odd ball to deviate, and especially so when the man running in to open the bowling was Bill Bowes. William Eric Bowes was an unlikely-looking cricketer. Standing tall at 6 feet 4 inches, bespectacled, blonde curly hair with a clumsy gait, he certainly did not resemble a professional athlete. Yet Bill Bowes, with ball in hand, was destined to become one of the best of his time. With no nursery established in his home county of Yorkshire, Bowes was dispatched to Lord's to learn his trade on the ground staff under the watchful eye of Walter Brearley. And it would be his tutelage, along with Bowes' own insatiable appetite for improving his game, that would shape the young bowler. Every day, at 4 o'clock, Brearley would bounce into Lord's to coach the Yorkshireman. Resisting the temptation to try and mould his young charge into an express quick, Brearley persuaded Bowes to cut down his run to 10 yards, saying how he'd really like to make it 8. Instead, he taught him the art of skillful, fast-medium bowling, the use of the crease, of control and swing through the air. Bowes would pound to the wicket in his usual ungainly style, a mostly side-on delivery and a quick veer away from the pitch in a follow-through that left him watching the batsman's reaction from over his shoulder. He was not rapid, but the ball often came off the pitch much quicker than expected. Bowes, under Brearley, proved a willing student, and by 1929 had made his Yorkshire debut. One thing continued to elude him, the away swinger. It was, according to Brearley, the ball you have to bowl to fully reach potential. Despite his mentor's instructions, Bowes could not master it, but refused to settle for being an in-swing bowler only, and doggedly kept on seeking the magic formula. It took him 3 years of trying, and in 1931, he finally cracked it. a tip picked up in an obscure coaching manual about the position of a bowler's feet on delivery did the trick, and soon Bowes was moving the ball both ways without any noticeable change in his action. He quickly became the leader of the Yorkshire attack, discouraged from paying too much attention to batting practice or exertions when in the field, anything that might distract him from the job of taking wickets. His evolution into an all-round swing bowler saw Bill Bowes given an England chance, and although he would perform well, taking 6 wickets on debut, his international career would be one of fits and starts. That he lacked that extra yard of pace compared to the likes of Larwood, Vos and Allen made him susceptible to being the first one of the attack to drop out when a change in balance or of personnel was demanded. Even so, 68 wickets from 15 tests at an average of 22 was reasonable, and one suspected would have been greater were it not for the interruption of war. At Hove, operating in tandem with the right-arm medium pacer Frank Smales, Bowes nearly got an early reward when he forced a full stroke from John Langridge, only to see the sharp chance go to ground at gully. As expected though, there were few demons in the surface, and the Sussex openers soon realised that just by playing with a straight bat, taking few risks, and waiting for the hittable delivery, runs would come. Something each proved with drives through the covers of the Yorkshire opening pair. Even on this pitch though, this was a quality attack, and with only 26 on the board, Bowes drew Stainton into offering an edge, which was snapped up by wicketkeeper Arthur Wood. Next to the wicket was Harry Parks, brother of the match beneficiary James. A new batsman, but no changing tactics from the Sussex pair, steady as she goes. It was low-risk cricket, but with the bowling taking on an air of a dead rubber, runs still came at a steady rate. Bowes particularly seemed lethargic as he reeled off over after over for more than an hour. It would take a brilliant act of wicket-keeping and an inept piece of running between the wickets for Yorkshire to remove these cautious batsmen. The breakthrough came after Yorkshire's normally sharp fielding let one get away. With the score on 81, Frank Smales got Harry Parks to prod outside off, only to see the ball elude the hand of Arthur Mitchell low down at first slip. No matter, only 8 runs later, Park fenced at a ball from the same bowler, and this time, keeper Wood left nothing to chance, diving full length and low to take a catch in front of the slips. It looked highly unlikely that the cautious John Langridge would be tempted into a similar fate, and at 1:15 he raised his bat for a watchful 50. The Sussex score having moved into 3 figures some 10 minutes before. The fact that Langridge would not survive to lunch was down to the eagerness of his new batting partner, George Cox. Cox had come to the crease with a clear intention of moving the score along quickly with his usual gusto, driving Smales through the covers for a boundary off the very first ball he received. Such forthright intention was welcomed by the home crowd, but in his keenness to take the attack to the county champions, Cox saw his partner off. Pushing a ball from Verity to Wilf Barber at mid-off, he called Langridge through for a single that was never there, and the Yorkshire man made no mistake with his throw. Langridge, out for 60, the score on 133-3. On the way back to the pavilion, he passed his brother James, bat in hand, making his way out to the middle. George Cox seemed to like batting against Yorkshire. In the 24 matches they were his opponent, 23 times for Sussex, once for the Royal Air Force, Cox averaged 43.41 with 5 50s and 6 centuries to his name, including one double, 212 at Headingley in 1949. When George Cox scored runs he was a joy to watch, powerful, inventive, but certainly no slogger. And while he was at the crease, the scoreboard operator would get little rest. Such a carefree approach to his craft brought with it the obvious hazards, and George finished his career with a healthy 77 first-class ducks. 76 of them for his county. Not quite a Sussex record, but enough to put him comfortably in their top 10. The county's record for being dismissed without score, an impressive 126 times, was held by George Cox's father, the left-arm bowler George Rubens Cox. While many would have liked to have seen it, George Jr. was never afforded the opportunity to don an England cap. He can consider himself somewhat unfortunate to be overlooked. It took a few seasons for his batting to flourish, but from 1937 onwards he was a consistent performer for Sussex and had enough standout years to come to the selectors' attention. In 1949 he scored 1,938 runs, an average of 40.37. The next year he passed the 2,000 run mark at an average of 49.5. Perhaps the odd dip in form would scupper those chances. The stellar years of 1949 and 1950 were sandwiched between seasons with an average in the low 20s, featuring a lone century each time. Or perhaps his attacking verve was seen as too much of a risky luxury for the Test arena. Whatever the reason, George Cox would finish his first-class career at the age of 50 with no international recognition, but with the plaudits of those who had seen him in full flow. When play resumed after lunch, George Cox had no intention of reining in his attacking instincts, driving, cutting and pulling with great power. Of course, he flirted with danger, the odd ball passing the edge of the bat, a few flying close to the outstretched hands of the slips, but mostly the highly able Yorkshire fielding was employed in an effort to prevent another boundary. It took Cox only 10 minutes of the afternoon session to move from his lunchtime 22 to a warmly greeted half-century. At the other end, James Langridge, a quality left-handed batsman, capped 8 times by England, and who was one of Wisden's Cricketers of the Year in 1932, was almost a spectator, taking the occasional run when on offer, but was mostly content to let Cox go on his merry way. In what seemed a blink of the eye, the partnership between Cox and Langridge had passed 50, and at 3:10, the Sussex score to 200. 200, though, meant the new ball was available, and Yorkshire captain Brian Sellers had no hesitation in recalling his opening pairing of Bowes and Smales back into the attack. The hard new cherry seemed to inject life into the bowling, and soon the partnership was broken. Bowes found the edge of James Langridge's bat, Arthur Mitchell taking the catch at slip with little fuss. It was time for the match beneficiary, Jim Parkes, to make his entrance. While the welcome to the middle would have been warm, his stay was brief. With only 2 runs to his name, Parkes tried to carve a ball from Frank Smales hard through the gully and only found the hands of Ellis Robinson, who took a smart catch. In no time at all, 202/3 had become 205/5. If the Hove crowd had been disappointed in Parkes' misfortune, the sight of Hugh Bartlett with a bat in hand would have raised their spirits. Bartlett was a dashing, hard-hitting left-hander who could produce spectacular performances such as his onslaught against the Australians in the previous year, where he reached 100 in less than an hour, securing for him that year's Walter Lawrence Trophy for the quickest century, pipping his equally free-scoring teammate George Cox. The prospect of Bartlett and Cox batting in tandem was always an enticing prospect. On that afternoon, though, the anticipated fireworks did not come. The Yorkshire bowling was back to its normal high standard. Bartlett found it difficult to free his arms, and Cox started looking difficulty when facing up to Bowes. Yet, despite some false strokes and near misses, the batsmen managed to keep their wickets intact, and runs began to accumulate. A couple of classic off-drives from Cox showed his rhythm returning, though it was a mishit that evaded the field, which allowed him to raise his bat for a well-received century. His century in the bag, George Cox began to swing his bat freely, taking runs from all bowlers, but particularly having fun with Hedley Verity, driving one of the slow left-armer's deliveries for 6, and then getting down on one knee to pull another to the boundary later in the same over. Wickets began to fall at the other end, but such was Cox's haste that decent partnerships were built with little input needed from the tail-enders. First, Bartlett went for an uncharacteristically restrained 24, bowled by one of Ellis Robinson's off-breaks, the partnership worth 61. Jack Holmes came and went for only 11, bowled Verity, but had hung around long enough for his partnership with Cox to have passed 50. T was taken with the score on 331 for 7, 154 of them from the bat of George Cox. On resumption, Cox took off from where he left, moving the score along as quickly as he could. His endeavour brought risks, of course, and it looked like his time was up when he tried to lift Verity over the infield once more, but only found Bill Bowes at mid-on, who spilled the head-high chance. Later in the same over, Cox's partner, Billy Griffiths, was not so fortunate, and Verity picked up his second of the innings, thanks to a smart one-handed catch by Frank Smales at mid-off. At a quarter past five, all eyes were on the middle as George Cox faced up to Ellis Robinson, needing just two more runs for a thrilling double century. Robinson trotted in and served up the hittable delivery that Cox was waiting for. A touch short, a little wide, ripe for the cut. Unfortunately for the Sussex man, he didn't manage to get on top of the shot and hammered the ball straight into the waiting hands of Arthur Mitchell. It had been a scintillating innings, warmly appreciated by the Hove crowd. His efforts had moved the Sussex score to 387, and there it would remain, as Jim Wood, in at number 11, lasted precisely one ball. The umpire's finger sent him off LBW and brought the innings to a close. The South Coast sunlight was holding up and promised Yorkshire a full 90 minutes to eat into the Sussex lead. It was, though, an unusual opening pair of batsmen who strode to the crease to begin the champion's reply. Wilf Barber and Len Hutton. But one can say that Leonard Hutton was only just getting into his cricketing stride when war put a halt to serious sporting competition is an indication of the extraordinary heights his career would reach. For when stumps were finally drawn at Hove, Len Hutton's record was already one to admire. Since making his Yorkshire debut as a prodigious 17-year-old in 1934, he would be run out for a duck at his first time at the crease. Hutton had, by the end of 1939, racked up 11,500 runs at an average of scratch under 49, including 36 centuries. England recognition came in 1937 against New Zealand at Lord's, though, as with his county debut, his first innings would end scoreless. His second in the match would not be much better, out with only one run to his name. No matter, retained for the next match, Hutton, opening alongside Gloucestershire's Charlie Barnett, would register his first century. It would be his only score of note in the series, but the 21-year-old had given notice that he belonged at the highest level. 1938 brought the Ashes series that would secure Len Hutton's place in the history books. With a century already secured in the first match, the final match at the Oval would change everything. Only 29 runs were on the board when Hutton lost his opening partner, Bill Edridge, and was joined by the familiar face of Maurice Leyland. The Yorkshire pair put on an incredible 382 runs together, breaking the English Test partnership record for the second wicket. When Leyland was out for 187, Hutton ploughed on, often at a snail's pace. By the time he was out, the score on 770 for 6, Len Hutton, with 364 runs to his name, held the record for the highest individual score in a Test match. It would be a distinction he would hold for 20 years until the great Garfield Sobers bettered Hutton's score by a single run. It does, though, remain unsurpassed by any English cricketer today. The pre-war Hutton was graceful yet determined. Great touch allied with huge reserves of concentration. Bowling attacks could be taken apart, but many innings were characterised by patient occupation of the crease that wore the opposition down. At times the runs came slowly, but come they did. 1936 would be his first 1,000-run season. 1937 brought 2,888, and in 1939, only 5 runs fewer. He was poised for greatness, but then war came and looked, for a time, to have brought a premature end to his cricketing days. It was not enemy fire that fell Hutton, but an accident during a commando training course when a mat slipped from under his feet, leaving the Yorkshireman with a fractured left arm. It was no simple recovery. Operation followed operation, and over a year later his arm was still in plaster. When the cast was finally removed, it revealed a shrunken limb that was permanently shorter than the other. When Len Hutton eventually picked up a cricket bat again, the gap had been 3.5 years. That Len Hutton learned to adapt to his altered physique remained classically correct, though the hook would no longer feature in his game, and did so to a professional level was admirable enough. That he went on to become one of England's greatest players is extraordinary. 1946 began a run of 8 consecutive 1,000-run seasons, including 2,000 runs in 1948, 1950, 1951, 1952 and 1953, and in excess of 3,000 in 1949. When Hutton retired from competitive first-class cricket in 1955, he could reflect on a career that had brought over 40,000 runs and 129 centuries, including 19 for England. Such was his impact on the popular imagination that Len Hutton became Sir Leonard Hutton soon after his retirement. He would also be the man who finally broke the symbolic line of class when, in 1952, playing as a professional, Hutton was appointed England captain. It was not the death knell for the amateur captain. The honour reverted back into the hands of amateurs immediately after Hutton. But the line had been crossed, and from that, there was no going back. As with most openers, Hutton would be forever linked with the men with whom he shared the opening berth. For England, it was Cyril Washbrook, whose combined 2,880 Test match runs sits 11th on the all-time list. For Yorkshire, despite the fact that their careers only crossed in the immediate pre-war years, the names that trip most easily off the tongue are those of Len Hutton and Herbert Sutcliffe. Both were from the small market town of Pudsey, and it had been Sutcliffe himself who sold Hutton his first proper bat. When Hutton made his Yorkshire debut, Herbert Sutcliffe was firmly established in the England side and was the marquee name on the Yorkshire team sheet. In 4 years of regularly opening together, they would score 15 century partnerships for the county. On this sunny Hove afternoon, however, Herbert Sutcliffe was absent. As an army reservist, he was one of the first cricketers to be called up for service, and while his teammates were seeing out the last rites of the county season, Herbert was joining up with the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. In his place, Wilf Barber had been promoted to open. Barber, who had made his Yorkshire debut in the tail end of the 1926 season and had briefly represented his country against South Africa in 1935, was a classical offside batsman with a sound defensive technique. He was no novice in the opener's berth, but had, throughout his career, moved up and down the order depending on the needs of the team. Hutton and Barber settled quickly into their task and made both pitch and bowling look benign. Runs came easily from both ends with little sign of a Sussex breakthrough. Hutton, powerful from timing through the offside, delicate when playing to leg. Half an hour into the Yorkshire innings and the 50 partnership had been posted, 22 from the bat of Wilf Barber. He would add no more, attempting a late cut at a ball from the Sussex left armer John Nye, Barber found himself cramped for room and edged it into the safe gloves of Billy Griffiths. The reliable Arthur Mitchell was next in. 36 years old and capped 6 times by England, Mitchell had gained a reputation as a resolute onside player. But he was no less effective, and such impressions often ignored the fact that he was more than able on the offside when the match situation called for a more ambitious approach. At first, the Sussex bowling to Hutton and Mitchell was tight, keeping a good line and length. But as the shadows lengthened, the batsmen refound their rhythm, and when stumps were drawn at 7 o'clock, they had moved the score along to 112 for two, Hutton's half-century secured. Thursday, August the 31st, 1939, day two. The contrast with day one could not have been greater. Gone were the blue skies and the sunshine. In their stead were heavy grey clouds and persistent rain, the remnants of a wicked storm that had swept across Sussex overnight. Unfortunately for Jim Parkes and his benefit fund, the wet weather also meant the absence of the paying public who had shown such great support the day before. No cricket, no crowd, no gate receipts. The prospects did not look good either. Rain continued to fall throughout the morning, and although it relented after lunch, the effects on the playing surface did not bode well for a speedy resumption. For the players, all they could do was sit and wait, try to entertain themselves, and perhaps leaf through the morning newspapers or turn on a wireless for some clue as to their country's future. The news was not good. War, it seemed, had taken another step closer. In the early hours of the morning, the German Foreign Minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, had met with the British ambassador, Sir Neville Henderson, and handed him a list of demands regarding Poland, including the handing of Danzig over to German control and a plebiscite to determine the fate of the Polish corridor. The Polish government were given to midnight to send an envoy with full power to negotiate an agreement. When the Polish ambassador, Joseph Lipski, contacted von Ribbentrop later that day and declared that he could only receive the demands as an ambassador with no authority to sign any agreement, Adolf Hitler took to the airways to declare that he considered his terms rejected. This announcement came only minutes after the ratification of the Nazi-Soviet pact, which had cleared an important obstacle in the path of German eastwards expansion. Given the obvious and imminent nature of German intentions towards Poland, a country both Britain and France had treaty obligations towards should it be attacked, the implications were clear. As a result, the British government began to speed up its move onto a war footing. It took a decision to complete the mobilisation of the Navy, call up the remainder of the regular and supplementary Army Reserve, increase the call-up of Air Force volunteers, and put into place ARP emergency measures, including round-the-clock work on public air shelter construction. One further announcement on that wet Thursday brought the reality of a wartime Britain into sharp focus. Operation Pied Piper, the plan to evacuate a predicted 3 million children and other vulnerable people from those cities and towns considered most at risk from aerial bombardment, was set into action. The next day, September the 1st, from early in the morning, children were to gather at designated railway and London tube stations carrying their gas masks, clothes and toothbrushes, names written on labels pinned to their coats, to begin the journey away from their families to, they hoped, safety. Some of the 500,000 London children who were to be evacuated on that first day would be heading to the south coast, including 14 trainloads, which were to head into Brighton Station. The rapidly developing crisis was not lost on the players of Yorkshire, sat in their hotel, waiting for the rain clouds to pass on by. Norman Yardley recalled that all morning, "We were feverishly discussing the cables from Poland and Germany. None of us had much attention to give to cricket." Finally, in mid-afternoon, the sun made an unexpected yet welcome return, and at 3 o'clock the umpires declared conditions fit for play, the contest to resume half an hour later. In cricketing terms at least, the Sussex players must have thought the gods were on their side. Runs on the board, a lead of over 250, and now a wet pitch to make mischief on their behalf. Determined to make most of the change conditions, Sussex skipper Holmes went on the attack. It was to be the left-arm pairing of John Nye from the sea end, both mid-on and mid-off in close, crowding the bat, and James Langridge from the other, two slips in place. To what extent the pattern of the afternoon's play was because of, or despite, the pitch depended on whose report you believe. For the special correspondent of the Times newspaper, the surface was easy despite the earlier downpour. According to Jim Kilburn of the Yorkshire Post, the ball carried through sluggishly and at varying and illogical heights. For Kilburn, any apparent ease was entirely due to the brilliance of Len Hutton. Hutton simply refused to allow whatever demons that might lurk in the pitch to have their way. Using his feet, particularly to the quicker deliveries of Langridge, Hutton denied the ball any chance to land, let alone spin, until, that is, the bowlers dropped so short that he could hang back and punish the resulting long hop. It was a sumptuous exhibition of hitting, showcasing drives, pulls, square cuts and late cuts, and after three quarters of an hour, Hutton drove Jim Wood through the covers to notch his 14th boundary and a brilliant century. It hadn't taken long for Jack Holmes to ring the bowling changes, and after Parks, Nye, Langridge and Wood had chanced their arms, the Sussex captain turned to the hero of the bat on the first day of the match, George Cox. It was only the seventh time he'd been thrown the ball that season, but it was a stroke of genius, or luck, and with the very first ball he sent down, tempted a pull from Hutton, which missed, and the Yorkshire opener was on his way, LBW. Out for 103, leaving his side handily placed on 175 for 2, though still 212 runs behind. It had been no one-man show. Arthur Mitchell had seemed to have few problems with the changing Sussex attack and had already passed 50 runs. Even without Sutcliffe, this was a strong batting lineup. Seven of the top eight had England experience. Yet the departure of Hutton was an opportunity for Sussex. The obvious move for Holmes was to recall one of his frontline bowlers to have a crack at the new batsman, especially as the incoming Yorkshireman was the greatly experienced Maurice Leyland, who at 39 years of age could boast over 32,000 first-class runs, 41 England caps and 9 international centuries. However, the Sussex captain stuck with his instinct and not only chose to keep Cox going with the ball, but soon introduced another part-timer from the other end, himself. Given that in 17 years of cricket for Sussex, he had only taken 7 first-class wickets, the decision had a certain end-of-term feel about it. It worked. The Yorkshire scoring slowed, and just before tea, scheduled for 5 o'clock, the skipper, with his first ball, picked up his 8th career first-class wicket, Arthur Mitchell miss-hitting one high into the air, which was easily taken by James Langridge close to the wicket. Gone for a bright 67. Tea was taken, with the score at 204 for 3. After tea, Maurice Leyland, together with the young, talented all-rounder amateur sportsman Norman Yardley, looked to push the score along with purpose. Leyland took some time to find his rhythm, but soon both were taking runs off each of the Sussex bowlers, making the pitch, which had promised so much for the home team earlier, looked increasingly becalmed. Yardley gave one chance, a sitter dropped on the square leg boundary, but beyond that, the pair looked in total control. When stumps were finally drawn, the partnership had passed 100, Leyland on 62, Yardley 72, Yorkshire 330 for 3. Only 57 runs behind. A good session for the visitors, yet any pleasure the Yorkshire dressing room had taken from the day's play was dampened by the news that the popular Scarborough Festival, scheduled for the coming weekend, had been cancelled owing to the likelihood of war. Friday, September the 1st, 1939, Day 3. players awoke to grim news. In the early hours of the morning, the German invasion of Poland had begun. It had started with pre-dawn bombing of Wielan, escalated with the shelling of Danzig, and by 8 o'clock, German troops had crossed the border. While it would take 2 days for Britain to formally declare war, it was now inevitable, and all knew what that meant for the men, women, and children of every nation involved. It was no time for cricket. Surrey's match at Lancashire was abandoned, Derbyshire's at Leicestershire went as well with a hand from the weather, and the 3 games yet to start were cancelled. In Hove, Brian Sellers received a message from the Yorkshire committee suggesting they follow suit. Yet the captain demurred. Their match was being played as a benefit for Jim Parkes, and not only was he an extremely popular cricketer with his peers, but all knew the difference a decent payday could make to a professional, especially in times as uncertain as these. Who knew if he ever would get the chance again? So, after an exchange of views, the match was to continue. With only 1 day's play remaining, and Yorkshire's first innings not yet completed, Sellers decided they needed to move the game along. The remaining batsmen were to put quick runs ahead of preservation of their wickets, force a lead as soon as they could, and then see what the Yorkshire bowlers could do on a pitch that was visibly cutting up. Yardley and Leyland were to resume for the visitors under a blazing sun, and they quickly looked to make hay. The bats swung freely and risks were taken, the result of which was predictable. Runs came, but wickets fell. 12 had been added to the overnight score before the first man was on his way back to the pavilion. Maurice Leyland, attempting to launch Jim Parkes out of the ground, merely gave a steepling catch to the man at cover. Leyland had made a steady 64, part of a valuable partnership of 138 with Yardley. If Norman Yardley was to push his team into a lead and his own score into three figures, he would need some support at the other end. At first, it looked like this would come from his skipper, Sellers. But after a brisk 12 runs, the captain suffered the same fate as Leyland, and it was Hugh Bartlett who accepted the skied mishit in the covers. 363 for 5, and Yorkshire was still behind. The remaining batsmen did not hang around long. Frank Smales aimed a drive at a Parkes delivery, made no contact, and was bowled for a duck. Arthur Wood managed to get off the mark, but with only 2 runs to his name, fell to an excellent running catch by his namesake Jim Wood on the square leg boundary. Ellis Robinson missed one from Jing Langridge without troubling the scorers, and at 377 for 8, it looked as though even a small first innings lead might be beyond them. Even more so when Yardley's fine stint at the crease came to an end with his team still 1 run shy of parity. He had, though, managed to raise his bat for an impressive century, finally gone for 108. If a lead was to be achieved, it would be up to Verity and Bowes, a somewhat unlikely pairing with bat in hand. They took to their task with purpose, and for the first time in the day, an element of caution entered the Yorkshire play. It paid dividend, to a degree, and when Bowes was caught by the match beneficiary Parkes, the score had crept up to 392, 5 runs ahead. It was now over to Sussex to play out the day and bring the 1939 English cricket season to a close. It would not be easy. The pitch did not look good. The combination of the rain of day two, the subsequent bright sunshine, and the marks left by the bowlers' feet had left a disturbed surface ripe for spin bowling. It would also be understandable if the batsmen's minds were on matters other than the cricket. Still, this was a pitch that had seen 2 Yorkshire centuries subsequent to the rainstorm, and so a drawn match was most likely. The problem for Sussex was that such conditions were made for Hedley Verity. It is fair to say that Hedley Verity scaled the cricketing heights that he did on account of his single-minded determination to become a Yorkshire professional, as much as his obvious natural talent. From an early age, young Hedley's passion was Yorkshire cricket, and everything else came second. It was a mindset that not everyone welcomed. And in his last year at school, Verity found himself excluded from all sporting activity by his headmaster. A punishment for playing truant in order to watch Yorkshire's second 11 play a match nearby. Fortunately, his parents were much more understanding. Having left school at 14, Headley was being lined up for a career in his father's coal business, working with a private tutor to learn secretarial and accounting skills. It was to prove a short-lived plan. "It's no use, Dad," Headley stammered. "You're wasting your money. I've made up my mind to someday play for Yorkshire." While he would continue with some office work at the coal depot, with his parents' blessing, every spare moment was devoted to his true calling. Corners of the office and hallways in the family home became impromptu nets as Headley honed his batting and bowling technique. The coal yard proved useful for Headley in bulking up his build, as did the footpaths of nearby Crag Wood, where he would run and skip in heavy work boots to improve his stamina further. Performances for his local team of Rawdon and later Horsforth Hall Park eventually brought him to the attention of Yorkshire, but when invited for a trial, opinion was not unanimously in his favour. He could play, no doubt, but for the watching Bobby Peel, Verity, operating as a seam bowler, was not fast enough, particularly for someone of his height. Still, the recently retired George Hurst saw something in the young cricketer and used his connections to secure Headley a contract with Accrington and then Middleton in the Lancashire Leagues. The period playing hard league cricket gave Verity a fine grounding in the game, but it was a decision to change his bowling style that saw him take the biggest step towards finally getting the county recognition that he craved. It had taken the intervention of a pair of Yorkshire greats, George Hurst and Wilfred Rhodes, to prompt the change. At a Yorkshire Nets session sometime in the late 1920s, Headley was taken aside by the two and advised that if he continued as a medium-pace bowler, he would face plenty of competition for a place at the county. If, however, he were to try his hand as a left-arm spinner, then with Rhodes himself eyeing retirement, who knew? With the support of his league club, the change was made, and after a few faltering steps, he had found his art. In 1930, aged 25, Headley Verity made his Yorkshire debut, taking 3 wickets in a match against Sussex at Huddersfield. 1930 was but an introduction, and the following season he hit his stride, taking 188 first-class wickets at an average of under 14, including 18 5-wicket innings, 4 10-wicket match hauls, and the rarest of all bowling feats, 10 in an innings. It would not be the only time that would be achieved. In 1932, he surpassed the 10 for 36 he had registered against Warwickshire the previous year, with an incredible 10 wickets for 10 runs on a turning Headingley wicket against Nottinghamshire. Though his son, Douglas, has said that he wouldn't reckon that 10 for 10 being as good as 1 for 60 in 40 overs on a batter's wicket, he only valued things which were difficult. Between 1931 and the outbreak of war, Headley Verity would pass 150 wickets each domestic season, 3 times passing the 200 mark, and ended that 1939 season with a career wicket total of 1,956 at an average of 14.9. All this in a period of cricketing history that was widely viewed as a batsman's. Verity's run-up was quicker than many spinners, but was still smooth, a glide to the wicket almost, and the ball delivered with a noticeable extra effort that pushed the ball through at near-medium pace. While he may not have spun it as far as some, he had full control, varying line, flight, curve, speed and spin to lure batsmen into the full stroke that would feed the slip cordon. Frequently operating in tandem with his good friend Bill Bowes, the pair ran through many a county side. In the 10 seasons they played together, Bowes and Verity accounted for over half of all Yorkshire wickets and were the backbone of the 7 county championship titles secured in that time. The two men were of a similar mindset when it came to working on their craft and spent long hours analysing the match gone by and plotting the downfall of the opposition in the next. Another man Headley felt similar affinity with was his England captain between 1931 and 1934, Douglas Jardine. Although Verity had little enthusiasm for the bodyline techniques employed on the 1932-3 Tour of Australia, he was fully supportive of his captain. The respect was mutual, and on their return home from Australia, the skipper wrote to Headley's father in praise of his son, calling him a real friend and a grand help to me. Headley Verity would have three sons. The first he would name after Wilfred Rhodes, the second after George Hurst, and the last would be Douglas, in honour of Jardine. His England career would not be plain sailing. There were times that he faced questions over his effectiveness on flat tracks, and would be omitted from the team on a few occasions. But by the time war came, he had racked up 40 caps and 144 wickets at an average of under 25. And no one would dismiss Don Bradman in tests more times than Headley Verity. It was to be Jim Parkes to open with James Langridge this time round, Bob Stainton having suffered a leg injury whilst in the field. He would have known that Verity could be lethal on a pitch that was cutting up, and Parkes saw off the first delivery watchfully. The second was a different matter, and he failed to meet ball with bat and was heading off without scoring, LBW. 0-1. Sellers was a canny skipper, and while Bill Bowes could be a handful on any surface, this was a morning for the slower bowlers. And to open at the other end, he turned to the off-breaks of Ellis Robinson. The switch paid off, and soon Robinson had a scalp. John Langridge, caught by the captain himself. From then on, it was Verity's show, taking advantage of this most helpful of pitches and his vast reserves of skill and experience. He bamboozled each and every one of the Sussex men with extravagant turn. Henry Parkes, George Cox, James Langridge, all caught off his bowling. Hugh Bartlett, Jack Holmes and Billy Griffiths, all bowled. The dismissal of Sussex captain Holmes exemplified the spell that Verity was weaving as he watched a ball pitch outside of leg stump, turn and clatter into off with no shot offered. The final indignity for the home side was an avoidable run out as John Nye drove Robinson to Hutton in the deep, and as the Yorkshireman fielded the ball, Nye called Jim Wood back for an inexplicable second run. Wood was a long way from safety when the bowler completed the run out. With Stainton unable to bat, the innings was over. 33 all out in only 11.3 overs. Verity's return, 7 wickets for 9 runs. A master at work. Verity's astonishing performance had guaranteed a Yorkshire victory, but it was not done quite yet. The last rites needed to be performed, 29 runs to secure the match. There was enough life left in the match for one last wicket to fall, Hutton out for one. But from then on it was straightforward, and at 2:30, shortly after lunch, Wilf Barber hit the runs that brought proceedings to a close. A Yorkshire win by 9 wickets, but that did not seem to matter much. All present knew that more important things awaited. Handshakes were exchanged, the pavilion and changing room grew crowded as friends took the chance to wish the players farewell. Spectators purchased scorecards as a memento of the last first-class cricket for, well, who knew how long. It was a sombre scene. Len Hutton, in particular, was said to look very pale. For Yorkshire, there was the practical matter of how to get home. The need of evacuees moving south made travelling by rail impossible, and many of the roads were out of use for the same reason. A green southbound coach, a charabanc in the words of the time, was commandeered, and the team climbed aboard for the long journey north. First along the coast of Havant, then up to Oxford and beyond, passing vehicles packed full of families together with most of their worldly goods, searching for safety. As the sun set, an undisturbed darkness fell, a blackout in place across the land. Driving through the pitch black, the mood on the coach took a similar hue. Hutton remembered that the further they went, the deeper was our conviction that we'd be lucky if we ever played cricket again. Night time upon them, the decision was made to stop for the night in Leicester. Time for one last meal together as a team. Oysters, no less, washed down with champagne. One by one, the players retired to bed until two figures remained, continuing their conversation into the small hours. Bill Bowes and Hedley Verity, such good friends, sat contemplating where their lives would take them next. Wherever that was, they wanted it to be in each other's company, and given that Bowes's wife, Esme, was soon to give birth, they agreed that they would join the air raid precautions until the child's arrival, and only then pledge themselves to full military service. It would be over 6.5 years later before the county championship would resume. First-class English cricket in other forms reinstated in late 1945, the year before. Despite the lengthy hiatus, 20 of the 22 who played in that final peacetime game at Hove would return to play first-class cricket again. Not all would return for their counties. For Jim Parkes, his benefit game would be his last in the Sussex colours. It had netted him £734, an amount inevitably depressed by the circumstance and weather. He would, though, play a handful of first-class matches in New Zealand, and one final game on home turf, representing a Commonwealth 11 against the Indians in Blackpool in 1952. For his captain, Jack Holmes, who was aged 40 when he led Sussex for the final time in 1939, it was no surprise that he would not be back. It was not the end of his cricket, and he played various matches for the Air Force and other teams before finally packing away his pads in 1944. It was also Hedley Verity's last. Good to his word, he and Bowes signed up to the ARP and awaited the arrival into the world of Vera Bowes. Safely delivered, the two friends arrived together at the Bradford recruiting office and signed up. At first they were employed as lorry drivers, a difficulty in sourcing uniforms that fitted the pair solved by a call to Captain Herbert Sutcliffe, who was in ordnance. But soon a chance of infantry commissions came their way. Unfortunately, Bill Bowes was judged physically unsuited to infantry duties due to surgery that had been carried out on one of his knees. They had always pledged to stick together, but knowing how much his friend wanted to serve, Bill persuaded Hedley to go on without him. "This is war, Hedley," counselled Bowes. "When there has been a test match, and I've not been picked, you have still gone and done your damnedest. It's the same way here." Thus, Captain H. Verity joined the Green Howards at the end of 1939. Bowes was headed for the Officer Cadet Training Unit. Verity soon proved himself as a natural leader with an aptitude for military strategy, studying the subject as keenly as he had learned his left-arm spinners. War took him first to India, then Persia, and finally to Sicily, where Hedley led a company in an attack on a German division holed up in a farm building in Catania. In the fog of battle, Verity's men found themselves ahead of the leading company and took the full force of the German guns. The captain was among those injured, and when found the next morning, taken prisoner. He had been hit in the chest and was ailing. The German doctors worked hard to save him, operating to remove part of a rib that was causing him difficulty. But it was to no avail, and Hedley Verity died on the 31st of July 1943, aged 38. Bill Bowes had, by this time, also seen action, and was himself a prisoner of war, first in Italy, and then following the Italian armistice in Germany. It was while in Chieti, Italy, that Bowes heard the news. Some recently captured Canadian airmen had casually mentioned that they had seen some cricketer guy named Verity at a hospital in Caserta. "Do you mean that Hedley Verity was in hospital?" asked Bowes. "Yeah, that's the fella," responded the airman. "But he's not in hospital now. He was buried yesterday." As Bowes recalled, "I walked out into the deserted roadway through the camp. The wind was cold, but I did not notice it." In 1946, the county championship began once more. Yorkshire away to Glamorgan in their first match. Brian Sellers returned as captain. Pulling on his county blazer, Sellers noticed a small sheet of paper in the top pocket. It had been given to him by the scorer all that time ago at Hove. It read, "Verity, 6 overs, 1 maiden, 7 for 9.
For a while we must part, but remember me, sweetheart, till the lights of London shine again."
Thank you for listening to Cricket in England through 5 matches. This was the last in the current series. Particular thanks must go to Stephen Chalk for assistance on this episode's match. The transcripts of this series will be available in book form later in the year. Details will be posted on cricketstuff.blog and via Twitter @cricket_stuff. Cricket in England through 5 matches has been a production of Cricket Stuff.
Wear a smile and carry on till the lights of London shine again.